You are listening to the one and only Red Ice Radio. I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, or Gothia, as this land originally was known as. A warm welcome to everyone tuning in from across the globe, and a special welcome to all our members. You can catch our program three times per week at redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. We have news and radio RSS feeds, apps, and a number of ways that you can listen to the program. And I urge everyone enjoying our efforts at Red Ice to sign up for membership with us to get the most out of the program, enjoy the full broadcast and our archives filled with amazing knowledge, controversial ideas, and perspectives that we hope will challenge you. RedIceMembers.com is where to sign up. Today, Scott Onstad is back with us. He is the maker of the video series Secrets in Plain Sight. This is an exploration of art, architecture, and urban design, which unveils an unlikely intersection of geometry, politics, numerical philosophy, religious mysticism, new physics, music, astronomy, and world history. Our focus today, however, is his latest book, Taking Measure, Explorations in Number, Architecture, and Consciousness. The book reveals patterns emergent in our universe from quantum to astronomic scales. Spatial and temporal codes appear in unexpected places, from our units of measure to the relationship between celestial bodies. This book takes a new look at familiar structures in the tangible world, but also engages with the invisible world, including the question of consciousness. Hi, Scott. Hope you've been doing well since you were with us last time. It's always such a treat to have you with us, and you have so much knowledge on the esoteric numerology, architecture, and all the other systems that you've studied as well. So welcome back, Scott, and thank you for coming on again with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show, Henrik. It's a pleasure.
You bet. I thought we could begin to talk a little bit about your latest book, Taking Measure, Explorations in Number, Architecture, and Consciousness. I've been going through the book the last couple of days, and I really have been enjoying it. There are some gems in there, as it is when you in your two excellent films as well, Secrets in Plain Sight, both Volume 1 and 2. But tell us a little bit of why you wanted to write the book, Scott.
Well, it was sort of an effort of going back over my two volumes of Secrets in Plain Sight, and letting it percolate through me and trying to figure out what it all means, and trying to give even more detail and more examples and a little bit more clarity in my thinking I try to express in this book. And I'll let you be the judge of whether I was successful with that or not.
I think you were. Yeah, I think exactly. There was It's also another kind of aid, I guess, in terms of what is available in the films and everything, and it gives people a little bit more. There's always more contained in a book there, because it just, you know, as you know, once you begin to add in images and do the narration, it gets long pretty quick, you know. And I think your first volume is like 3.5 hours or something like that. And of course, there's a lot in there, but still, I think there's so much more contained in the book.
That's right. It's just the nature of the medium of the written word allows you to go into more detail and, you know, to give more examples and so on. It's not as enjoyable as a video, because a video is more passive. You just get to sit back and watch it unfold. And it requires a little bit more concentration and effort to, you know, get everything out of the book. But I think it's worth doing, you know, putting in that extra effort to really get these ideas, you know, in you and, you know, have them work on you more. I think, you know, it's a different thing, reading a book as opposed to a video, obviously.
Indeed. So how did you go about picking some of the subjects that you wanted to focus on? I guess both in the films as well that you did, but in the book primarily.
Well, I tried to break it down into the major categories of phenomena that I am profiling in Secrets in Plain Sight. And, It just sort of naturally organized itself, and there are 9 chapters, and that was maybe a lucky accident, because 9 is so important in my thinking, in how the decimal system seems to be not just an arbitrary system that we've chosen, but something that's written into the very architecture of the universe. And so the first chapter is about the decimal system and the Ennead, which is the Ennead is the 9 gods that were venerated in Heliopolis in ancient Egypt. And then I go on to talk about metrology and examining different units of measure, and how the units of measure themselves encode patterns that we see in the cosmos and in the very size of the our planet and the moon and the sun and the distance between them and so on. And then chapter 3 is about measuring time in the different ways that we do measure time. And again, the way that we measure time encodes these things. And so, in a sense, these are secrets in plain sight that we use every day, but I'm trying to draw our awareness to these patterns that are encoded in the very units that we use and the way that we take measure of the universe.
You do that very well. I think that of all the different things that you've brought together, has, you know, as you went through this yourself and discovery and doing research and everything, was there like a level of surprise for you all the time as you were discovering this, or were you pretty much accustomed to it and it was just a matter of like bringing it all together? How was the process for you as you researched and put it all together?
Well, it's basically one epiphany to another, one sense of total amazement to another. And over time, when I've had so many of these epiphanies, I've sort of become used to it in a way,
right.
But I still feel the wonder and awe when that does happen, although I'm not so surprised, but I'm grateful for it. I really enjoy that sensation of having kind of a blown mind or opening my awareness into even larger possibilities. I really enjoy that expansive feeling of awareness, you know, encompassing more and more of the universe and all the patterns that I recognize there.
Yeah.
I try to express that in the book with going into certain key numbers and then looking at patterns within number itself. And I also hit upon a very fundamental relationship, which is simply the relationship of 6 to 5. And I go into that in the chapter that I call the honeycomb and the apple, because I chose these two prototypical examples in the natural world that express the number 6 in the hexagonal honeycomb structure and in the apple. And so there's like a secret in the apple. If you cut the apple across its equator, you find a 5-pointed star. And so this is, I think of it as a secret in plain sight, because most of the time, you know, when you're eating an apple, you cut it from pole to pole, and you just are unaware of that beautiful pentagon within
yeah,
the fruit.
That's right.
And in a way, this might be the forbidden fruit, because it's encoding this 5-pointed star. And maybe we can discuss that at some point today. Going into the angles that are part of the apple.
Well, I think one of my favorites, Scott, actually, of the chapters is the honeycomb and the apple, and the way you kind of break that down, the relationship between 6 and 5, but also, you know, how it extends further out into our natural principles. Maybe we can just get into that right now, actually, and talk a little bit about the, you know, you're going to B symbolism in the beginning, which is, you know, I've always been very, very intrigued with that, but just this relationship between how, you know, fruits basically and flowers, who also have a lot of, you know, pentagonal shapes in them, have this relationship with the bee, and that the bee represents the hexagonal shape. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a wonderful interplay between the honeycomb and the apple, because obviously we wouldn't have apples unless we had bees to pollinate the blossoms. And the bees wouldn't be able to live unless they had built a structure, a home for themselves. And how do they choose to do that? They do it in a hexagonal structure, because that's just built into the structure of reality. If you have a circle and you open a pair of compass, you know, arms out to describe that radius, and you draw that circle, you can take that same distance and start any point on the circle and mark off an arc. And as you walk around the circle, it automatically divides it into 6 parts. And so you see this expressed in snowflakes and in a pile of logs. In many places in the natural world, you find structure represented by this hexagon, or you can think of it just simply as the number 6. And the largest example I can find is the North Pole of Saturn, which has this hexagonal pattern standing wave in the gases of the planet. And I think that's really incredible. Also, that the size of that hexagon, the edge length, is approximately 8,640 miles, which is a key number. It's related to the sun. I think of that as the number of the sun. But furthermore, just yesterday, I opened an article someone forwarded me on that very structure on Saturn. And they had a video from the Cassini spacecraft of that hexagon moving, you know, over time. It's just a brief clip that shows the gases moving. And what really struck me and what was pointed out in the article was that inside the hexagon, there is a equilateral triangle. And then inside that triangle, there were two concentric circles of standing waves. And so you can think of that perhaps as the all-seeing eye of God, as the eye of providence that is represented on the dollar bill. You know, it's part of the world. It's part of the universe. It's a persistent structure at all scales, and it's a great key into the mysteries. This this geometry.
Exactly. Well, Saturn has been, you know, it's played a huge role, it seems, in human prehistory as well, and it's no surprise, I think, why these things come to us in the way they do. But the hexagonal shape, it you know, you demonstrate as well in the book of how this, you know, goes from the macro level down to some of the smallest levels. And one thing that I found really interesting as well is beyond just the bee symbolism and the honeycomb symbolism, we have the symbolism of the beehive, which has been a long-standing kind of esoteric symbol for a lot of secret societies as well. But there is this interesting connection to France as well. And you visited there recently as well. So tell us about the connection to France overall, Scott, here.
Well, the bee was really important to Napoleon. And, you know, Andrew Goff goes into this research the best I've seen. And he shows that Napoleon was interested in these 300 golden bees that were found in a Merovingian king's tomb. And actually, Louis XIV had them. And the symbolism of the bee goes all the way back to ancient Egypt. The pharaoh was known as He of Sejin Bee, which was a epithet that connected the pharaoh with both Upper and Lower Egypt, because papyrus sedge was the symbol of Lower Egypt, and the bee was the symbol of Upper Egypt. And so the bee is a really interesting creature, because it you know, you have these drones going out and collecting all of the nectar, and then they bring it back to the hive, and it's almost like a royal structure, because you have the queen in charge, and she's the one who receives all of this work or wisdom from all of the workers. And so the bees are very industrious, going out and doing the work all day.
Yeah.
And so the beehive is a very important symbol, I believe, in Freemasonry. And it was encoded into the state of Utah in that the beehive state, and the state motto is industry. And inside Washington Monument, I think it's at the 220-foot height, there is a plaque there that says, has a beehive on it, and it says, Holiness to the Lord, and it has an all-seeing eye above it. And below that it says, Deseret, which means beehive. And it comes from the Book of Mormon. It's connected with that.
Interesting.
So I find it, you know, it's right there in plain sight, this connection. And but the bees, again, I see the significant aspect is the way that they've chosen to structure their home is with this pure geometry. You know, you don't often see this kind of pure geometry in nature just right in front of you.
Yeah.
And so the beehive is really an incredible example of sacred geometry, using the most efficient shape for structure. I'm just looking at my book here on that chapter and looking at some of the pictures here, and I noticed I talked about the unit of the Laplace. There was a French mathematician, Laplace, who was considered to be sort of the Newton of France, as the most brilliant man of his time. And he thought that the ancient Mesopotamians used a unit of 555 millimeters, which I call the Laplace, for lack of a better name.
Yeah.
But there are this number, 720-72072 Laplaces in the meridian circumference of the Earth. And I find that kind of amazing because, you know, 72 or 720 is a very key number. And we have this incredible repetition of this code that's expressed from the unit of 555 millimeters. And so this is where some people might lose me, because they think, okay, wait, is the metric system part of this? Well, you really have to keep an open mind and keep reading to understand that actually, yes, the metric system is based on the Earth, and it is a sacred measure, just as the units of foot and mile are, for different reasons. But I try to bring light to all of that metrology in taking measure. For example, 6/5, that's 6 divided by 5, times 33,333,333 meters is the polar circumference of the Earth, and that's 99.98% accurate. So it's this relationship of the honeycomb to the apple, as expressed in 6 divided by 5, multiplied by this string of threes, these repetitive single digits that encodes the size of the Earth. And so the meter is actually a sacred unit, as you can see from that expression. And I think it was Christopher Knight and Alan Butler talked about the meter in ancient times, in how it was used to encode the size in a place called Thornborough, where there are three henges. And they were concluding that they chose the meter because of a pendulum. If you have a pendulum that's a meter long, its period of oscillation will be 2 seconds, 1 second in each direction.
Yeah, that's right.
And so they found maybe they hit upon this length simply because of that connection with time. And I think that's very likely.
Huh. And again, we're back to France being the one who were kind of pushing this through, basically, to get this new measurement system there. And this also has to do with basically the old meridian that used to go through France, the Rose Line, I think it was called. So France has a long history of being tied to these sacred numerical systems, basically.
That's right. I think that the meter, which we know was the birth of it, was probably in the 1700s. But I think that it was really a rediscovery of an ancient unit, and it was brought out again. That's possible that there was sort of a conspiracy there in full knowledge. But it is also possible that this length was just stumbled upon, because they defined the meter as a distance of 40,000 units going around the meridian of the Earth as it passes through Paris, the the North Pole and the South Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just chose 40 million units, and that ends up being the meter, which is quite odd. And also the Great Pyramid, the actual latitude of the Great Pyramid. Now I don't have it in front of me right now, but it's 29.9 something degrees north. And if you look at it to like something like 8 significant digits, it precisely encodes the speed of light in meters per second. Because it uses the same digits.
Wow.
And this was something, I think it was John Charles Webb Jr. pointed that out on his website, and I found that and I verified it. And I find that incredible. Is it just a coincidence that the exact location of the Great Pyramid encodes the speed of light in meters per second? Perhaps it is. But I think the chances of that are very minute.
Well, it's exactly. It's north 31.1342, the latitude north and or east, sorry, and then you have the speed of light is 31.134417. So it's darn close. It's very close.
Yeah. I'm talking latitude, not longitude. Let me just see if I can find that.
Yeah.
Here it is. So the speed of light is 299,792,458 meters per second. The latitude of the Great Pyramid is 29.9792458 degrees north. So it's exactly the same digits, but using a different system measuring degrees north compared to a rate in meters per second. But this is the type of pattern that I find in many places where you have the same digits in different units of measure.
Huh.
And so it's a synchronizing in places that we wouldn't expect to find. For example, I discovered that the distance from Silbury Hill to the Shard is 66.66 nautical miles. And that equals 123,456 meters.
And the Shard is in it's in London, right? The new building there, the Shard.
Yeah. So why would I draw a line between those two points? Because Silbury Hill is the tallest man-made mound. I think the tallest Neolithic mound in Europe, if I'm correct. And then the Shard is the tallest building in the European Union in modern times. So we have this connection between ancient and modern. And we have this synchronization of a repetitive single digit in nautical miles with this 123456 meters. And I never would have known there was a connection between nautical miles and meters. That took me totally by surprise. But when I saw that synchronization, I thought there's really something to this. It's not, what are the chances of that synchronicity happening? I think they're, I don't know how to calculate that, but it's obviously intentional. But then that leads us into possibly speculation that there has been a conspiracy to locate the Shard exactly where it is at 32 London Bridge in reference to Silbury Hill. And I actually, personally, I don't see that. I think that these coincidences are even deeper than, I don't really give people credit for that kind of metrological brilliance.
Right.
I think that, nevertheless, this distance implies consciousness at some level, does it not?
Yeah, it does.
We don't just see these random connections between very significant sites. I mean, if you see a connection between the gas station and the supermarket, it probably doesn't matter.
Right.
But if you see a connection between the tallest ancient structure in England and the tallest modern structure in England, that has a significance and a meaning. And so it's fair to look at the distance between them. I also look at the location of something on the Earth, as I said earlier, like with the Great Pyramid. I can also look at the orientation of the structure relative to true north. There are many ways to encode numbers or patterns, and I go into that in the book. I have a taxonomy of encoded structures where I go through all the different ways that I find patterns, so that I'm trying to give you the toolkit to see the world the way I do, to be able to look at two sites and compare them and see if there's any harmony there. So I try in this book, I tried to express that as clearly as I could, so that you can follow my thought process.
Yeah.
And decide for yourself if it makes sense to you, or if maybe I'm just imagining these patterns where it's just coincidental and
I don't think so. In meteorology, can you, just to clarify that point then, can you use basically, what's so interesting here, what you just talked about, is that you can use ancient measuring systems or measures, either combine them or, you know, relate them to other ones. But basically, when you look at it, do you sometimes go for the ancient cubit, the meter, as you said, the megalithic yard, perhaps, sometimes feet, sometimes even, if it's about time, seconds, obviously, or nautical miles? Can you use anything, basically, because there is a relationship between them? Is that how you view it, Scott?
Yeah, I think everything is fair game, basically. My thinking isn't so limited just to accept SI units, but I also look at imperial units, I look at ancient units, I look at basically any metrological structure. And I'm looking at them to see if there's a pattern there or a basis in reality, if it wasn't just a seemingly arbitrary system.
Are there such things, do you think, arbitrary measuring systems out there?
Presumably there are, yes.
Yeah.
But I think that the systems that really catch on have a meaning to them that we might not perceive consciously, but nevertheless resonates with the universe. For example, the English foot. It was John Michel and Robin Heath who published the equatorial circumference of the Earth is equal to the number of days in a year times the number of degrees in a circle times 1,000 feet. And it's surprisingly accurate. If memory serves, I think it's in excess of 99.99% accurate. I think it's accurate within a mile. And so that's 365.242 times 360 times 1,000. And so that's the equatorial circumference of the Earth. And so to me, that says that the designers of the English foot took into account the year and the way that we measure circles.
Yeah.
And they multiplied it by a scalar factor of 1,000.
Hmm.
And so the foot is very intentionally designed. And then let's combine that with one other epiphany that came to me from a fan of Secrets in Plain Sight named Lawrence Edlund. He discovered that if you compare the an astronomical unit, which is the distance from the sun to the earth, the average distance from the sun to the earth, if you compare that distance to a light year, you know, a light year is a distance. It's the time light travels in one year.
Mm.
So if you compare the astronomical unit to the light year, it's the same as the relationship of the inch to the mile.
Hmm.
And I find that incredible.
Yeah.
You know, that we have this grandest of relationships of how the distance encoded in our orbital distance from our sun to the distance that sun's light travels in one of our revolutions of the sun, is encoded in the relationship of the inch to the mile. Is this just a coincidence, just a lucky thing that there was like a king's Bigfoot that happened to be that long and the mile was just a bunch of 5,000 paces or something? I don't know. But nevertheless, these patterns do exist. And I try to withhold judgment from how it or who did it until the last chapter of this book, where I get into four different types of possible encoders. And perhaps we can talk about that as well later.
Yeah, exactly. Let's definitely do that. You break that down very well, I think. And you know, it's a very interesting way that you go about thinking about that. In Talisman, Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall argues pretty much that the roots of you know, civilization and also then consequently the discoveries that they make in there, and that, you know, you also have made, you know, I see your work kind of taking on from what they, in some of the stuff that they did in that book as well, but they have an idea there that basically it's a religion at the root of it, in a way. This maybe extends out into theology in their work as well, and I don't know how much you look into that overall, but there seems to be a Gnostic, a, you know, slash secret society knowledge, based in these findings as well, and kind of encoded into all this. Would you agree with that, Scott?
I would agree with that, and also with Hancock and Bovall's later book, The Master Game, which is really a refinement of the ideas in Talisman. They make even a stronger case in The Master Game, as the title suggests, that it is a conspiracy, that it is a thread running throughout history of this knowledge that has been passed down. And I think that that is very valid and a very interesting take on history. It really makes history dynamic and exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
To realize that there's these people who've known all along, and perhaps they've made great efforts to encode some of this knowledge in plain sight. And I find that incredibly fascinating. I think Paris itself is a masterpiece of this occult or hidden knowledge. And I try to expose some of that in Secrets in Plain Sight.
You know, it was a few years ago now, probably, 10, 15 years ago since I was in Paris, maybe even more. I can't even remember now. But did you go through there recently when you were over in Europe on your trip?
Yeah, this spring we were in Paris, and I got a chance to go to the Louvre for the first time in my life and look down the historical axis and look at some of the esoteric monuments there, and it was just incredible. I really enjoyed it.
So what's your sense of it, Scott, as you were there and feel it, and you obviously there's a difference of looking at it on Google Earth, although that has its advantages as opposed to being there, you know, in the flesh with your spirit and everything and kind of sensing the place, feeling it.
Well, it really is. It's overwhelming when you're there, when you're aware of all of these patterns.
Yeah.
And it's really odd because almost nobody seems to be aware of it. Around me, I could be wrong. Maybe they are, but you know, I'm standing like in front of Bernini's sculpture of Louis XIV, right next to the entrance to the Louvre, right next to the glass pyramid.
Yeah.
And there's just a bunch of tourists around, and I think this is like almost like a holy point because this is the beginning of the historical axis. If you stand there and look towards the Arc de Triomphe de Carousel, you can see the obelisk in La Place de Concorde framed perfectly in the middle of that. And on a clear day, you can see all the way down to La Défense and see, you can see the Arc de Triomphe, and then you can see the Grand Arch in the distance. And this is a cascading increase of scale from the Arc de Triomphe de Carousel, which is at roughly at human scale, to the Arc de Triomphe, which is much larger, to the Arch in La Défense, which is that much larger. And so it's almost like this holographic resonance that occurs from Louis XIV, the Sun King, cast as Alexander the Great in this famous sculpture by Bernini, the same architect who designed St. Peter's Square in Rome. And so it's this connection of man to the stars. And it ramps up in each one of these stages down the axis.
Yeah.
And so I think this is the intent of this complex. But how many tourist buses talk about that, you know?
not too many. Well, despite, you know, all the law symbol and the Da Vinci Code, and I mean, I guess there may be a few more, but I think you're right, though, overall. I think people are still kind of not getting it, maybe. I don't know.
Well, maybe they're not, but what kind of irritates me is that these complexes are made and there's no explanation given.
That's just right. There. Yeah, I know.
And then you're supposed, I don't know, are you even supposed to know that? It seems to me that if I was the architect of, let's say, if I was I.M. Pei, I would want people to know all of these levels of beauty that are encoded. I would make a book about it.
Yeah.
You know? But for some reason, either he is not conscious of this, or he doesn't, or it's like the secret protects itself, you know, like it's there for those who have eyes to see.
Yeah.
But it's up to you to do the homework and to perceive these secrets in plain sight. Maybe that's it.
It's a good question, Scott. It was something I was thinking about as well as you were talking about this. If you've ever heard of anyone publicly speaking about this being nations or governments that, order the building or the statue or whatever, or the architects or other people involved in the project in some way. Have you ever heard anybody speaking in more esoteric terms about it, their creations?
Not overtly. I can read between the lines, you know,
yeah.
In different speeches that were given at the opening ceremony and I get a sense that people are aware of it, but I can't prove that. It's only a hunch I have, and it ties in with the interest in sort of the master game that there might be a group of people behind the scenes who are fully aware of this and are doing it for some reason. Presumably, it's very difficult to encode all this information right in front of people without people even knowing it. Or maybe it's not so hard. People are not, you know, often studying things like I tend to do.
Yeah.
And many others do. Many other people notice these patterns in different places, and they take it upon themselves to study these things, to look into them, to scratch the surface. Just because it's interesting in its own reward, really, to uncover these things. And, you know, a lot of it is made about how these conspirators might be the Illuminati and they might be, have a malevolent intent. And that may be the case, or it may not. But, what does it really mean to me? You know, I think that if they're using these universal patterns and universal codes and sacred geometry, all of those things are sort of neutral. They're tools. They're keys. And what you make of them is up to you. So if we can find these patterns in the world, then we need to really meditate on the meaning of those patterns. And perhaps they can be used for ill, and perhaps they can be used for good, just like any tool can. You can use a hammer to build a building or to whack someone on the skull.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
It's really your intention behind it, which is all important, I think.
Would you say, Scott, that some of the most symbolically charged or symbolically rich places are also some of the most praised, visited, and appreciated in the world? I'm just thinking of, you know, as you explained this as well, of all the tourists going to these locations, or, you know, old Gothic cathedrals, or, you know, we're still standing there today. Some of these are very, very old, you know, they can be 400 or 500 years old, sometimes even more, and people are, you know, amazed and in awe about these constructions, like we almost don't have the capacity to do it today. But if it's very, very visited sites, then it is strange to me that it's not being talked about, because you'd think then that would be the point of it, that the people would appreciate it even more if they knew what, you know, the numbers, if you will, behind it and how it was put together. But that makes me think that maybe there is something else going on, why it's being kept quiet. I don't know. What do you think?
It could be. I think that sometimes we give too much to the idea of conspirators behind the scenes planning everything.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps some of these things come about naturally, if you will.
Yeah.
Like, for example, if we look at Notre Dame in Paris, the distance from Notre Dame to Rosslyn Chapel in Scotland is 864 kilometers. There's that number, 864. The area of the largest square in Paris, La Place de la Concorde, is 86,400 square meters. There again, we have 864. The number of seconds in a day is 86,400 seconds. The diameter of the sun is approximately 864,000 miles. That's 99.9% accurate. So we have this connection between disparate phenomena. And yet it seems preposterous to think that there was a conspiracy to locate Rosslyn Chapel exactly where it is so that it would be 864 kilometers from Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, it was put there before the metric system was invented. Secondly, how could they survey a distance across the ocean, across the English Channel?
Mm.
You know, it seems impossible, and yet this is the fact.
There it is, yeah.
So that's why I try to withhold whodunit
right
until the end, where I give options, because it's like a web. It's very difficult to say it's all Satan behind it all, or it's all it's all the Illuminati who've done it all.
Yeah.
I just don't buy that. I think there's a place for the Illuminati, and there's definitely things that they're doing.
Is that, you know, is that the majority is that the majority kind of feedback or like correspondence level that you get from people on like?
No, actually not.
Okay.
On my YouTube page, there's all kinds of that sort of thing. But on secretsinplainsight.com, there's, I would say more positive feedback.
Yeah.
Or more, not so single-minded on a particular thing. Like, you know, the Ancient Aliens TV show?
Sure.
It's an excellent series, but, the problem I have in watching it for multiple seasons is that everything that they say has to be Ancient Aliens. It's the reason. And I think Ancient Aliens is a very interesting possibility in many ways, but I just don't think everything can be attributed to Ancient Aliens, and it gets really tiresome for me to, I mean, come on, break out of that mold. There are other possibilities here, and I think by having a preconceived conclusion, you really limit your investigation.
Oh, yeah.
So by keeping an open mind, then you can embrace perspectives, different perspectives that might conflict with each other. But you don't have to rule one out because it conflicts with what you think right now. You can keep it in play, you see, and then you can layer up all of these other possibilities as just that, as possibilities. And you can, over time, kind of come to some conclusions, provisional conclusions, personally, about how you think it works. But I think that we, all too often, people jump to a conclusion. And that limits their ability to assimilate more information or more grammar.
Yeah, it's very important. That's how you come closer to the truth, by weighing all these, different sides, if you will, different explanations, against each other, to be able to deduce what really is going on. And I believe you're right, Scott. I think a lot of people they're ready. They want to have a quick fix, a quick answer. But the fact is that reality is more complex and it's more nuanced. You have very many different agendas going on at the same time. I believe that there's a spiritual component to our existence on this planet, which means that we have, something more going on than just the matter itself. And beyond that, I think we also have potentially even an unconscious process that is part of this. So it's much more nuanced than that.
And how glorious is that, really, to look at the marvelous complexity of the universe, that there may indeed be a whole metaphysical realm which science jettisoned, and that we might now want to revisit with a scientific understanding, that there might be hyperdimensional beings that are influencing earthly affairs. They could be, you can think of them as angels and demons, or just your higher self, or there's so many different ways of calling these spirits that our ancestors seem to know a great deal more about. But it was necessary for us in our collective evolution to push all of that aside for a time, to develop the rational mind. And I think generally we've accomplished that. And it might be time to revisit the possibilities of a metaphysics as a means of explaining reality, or as a possibility, to go beyond scientific materialism is what I'm trying to talk about here.
Yeah.
I find that really an interesting area to explore.
Bridging our hemispheres, and also the source and origins of what we are as human beings. And I think that we do ourselves a great disservice by not recognizing, or rather throwing things out the window right away, because we haven't been able to prove them with our material instruments that are bound by the same rules, if you will, of what we're trying to measure with them, if you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, but it's interesting that by taking measure of the physical, that measurement points to, in my mind at least, non-physical reality, or a consciousness that transcends atoms.
Right, yeah.
And I find it a funny pun that the ancient Egyptians' god called Atum is said to be the first god, the one who arose from the watery abyss. And it is said that we are all Atum's flesh. And it's this funny wordplay between Atum and Atom, the quantum mechanical reality of the physical. And yet when we look deeper into that so-called substance, we find that the atom is made of 99.9999% nothing.
Yeah.
And so where is the something?
Yeah.
It is a ghost. It's a fascinating truth that's right there. But usually we ignore that and we just think of everything as having a physical cause, and everything must be explained in terms of the interaction of atoms.
Yeah. If you look at anything long enough, I think with intention or intense, if you will, you'll find the source or the spirit of the thing behind it. And I get what you're saying, that with measurement and long enough study on something, you'll be able to see that there is something that is transcending the object itself, relationships, etc., and the numbers behind it. Do you think that this has been missed primarily because people, again, they settle for an answer quick enough, let's say, or because it's you know, what you do is you look at things in a different way altogether. I guess it's about dot connecting, though, connecting the dots, right? Comparing it with other things.
It's somewhat pattern recognition and dot connection. It's continuing to look deeper and deeper and accepting conflicting viewpoints and learning more and more until it's sort of the path of the artist or scientist who looks out at the world, and if you look hard enough, what you will find is yourself. And this is the opposite path of the mystic who goes inward, and if you look hard enough in your interior, you'll find yourself. And so there's this beautiful connection there where whichever path you choose, you end up in the same place. At least that's how I look at it now. My latest blog post is called Something, Nothing, Everything.
Yeah, I read some of that. It's really well written. You share your personal story there as well, Scott, which is, you know, incredible in itself.
Well, thank you. I tried to express in that post my exploration of non-duality and how Secrets in Plain Sight, Volumes 1 and 2, and Taking Measure I've been on this quest I'm seeking to find. And eventually I realized that you can never find when you're seeking. And when you realize that you found that what you're seeking is yourself, you can stop seeking in a way after you've done enough of that and realize that the world is you. I don't know. I don't know if we want to go here, but...
Oh, sure.
This is sort of... the cat just dropped my phone.
I got a visitor, huh?
Yeah.
I know those cats. They can be... jump all over the place. I know that.
We have two kittens and they're a handful.
Oh, how old are they, by the way?
They're just 3 months old.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, it's like one of the worst periods. Well, up to 5-6 months, they're rascals, you know, so I know it.
Yeah. Where was I? I was just talking about going from the perspective of being something, being a body, to realizing that you're not that. You're actually, your awareness is not a thing. You're nothing, no thing. To realizing, either through an exploration of the interior or the exterior, that you are actually, your awareness is everything, and that there is only one awareness. The awareness that Henrik has and the awareness that Scott has is the same awareness, but it's conditioned through our body's history and our differences. So anyway, I see this sort of light within us all as being the one commonality that we all have, and that not only the people, but the universe. Because I see these patterns that are made by awareness. They're made by consciousness in all different scales. And so I have to conclude that ultimately we did that. And that's what, in the end of my book, I get into this encoder of the fourth kind as this final possibility, that ultimately we are the ones who have encoded all of this information. But we've done it through the agency of hyperdimensional beings, gods and goddesses, perhaps aliens, and conspirators, and just mundane everyday reality as well. So we have all of these different arms of ourself, if you will, that encode these secrets in plain sight. And the secrets in plain sight are there, available to us to perceive at any time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's where I'm giving you this kind of speech that I'm still struggling with and working on and trying to refine.
I know where you're going with it, Scott. I know definitely where you're heading with that, and I think it's in a way it seems to be where, you know, as you look at material things also then long enough and measurement and geometry and everything as we talked about here, you end up in eventually you become a mystic in a way. It becomes a spiritual a quest as opposed to one in finding numbers, you know. So I definitely know what you're going for and getting at.
Yeah, so taking measure isn't so much about this spiritual issues. It's mostly about the evidence that I have, and I try to make it very very scientific in its approach, even though I'm sometimes looking at things that mainstream scientists would have a problem with. But I'm just sharing with you part of my personal journey that I've been going on more recently.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we appreciate that, Scott. And before we carry on then, I want to ask you more about the encoders and everything else here and many of the other nuggets that you have in your book after we've taken a break here. But before we do that, let's talk where people can go to pick up a copy of your book, Taking Measure, Explorations in Number, Architecture, and Consciousness. And then I also want you to, of course, let any newcomers to your work know about Secrets in Plain Sight. You've also done a whole series on Washington, D.C. more recently, also available on your YouTube channel. So tell us about all these things and your website and where to go and such.
Well, my website is secretsinplainsight.com, and there you can find all of this work. It's all linked there, and I also have a blog with many posts that you can read that is a commentary on the work that I've done and also an extension of it. So I invite you to check out all of those resources at secretsinplainsight.com.
All right, very good. Well, Scott, we'll take a short break here at this point. Stay with us. We'll be back with more in just a little bit. We'll be right back.
Put on your red shoes and dance.
Don't miss the second hour with Scott Onstott. We proceed to discuss origins of knowledge, measurement, and the various units and standards. Our world used to be a world of myth, magic, gods, and symbols. And through the evolution of form and our own awareness, it might seem that these things have been lost, but we still have them within us. Scott talks about how we can move through the various stages in life and learn to integrate these faces in order to become what we are supposed to become. Later, he explains the four different types of encoders, as he calls them, who are responsible for the patterns that he has found, stretching from conspiracy all the way up to a higher force. We speculate about human origins, our DNA, and an alien intervention, and Scott says that everything is awareness and that we must enjoy the dance of life. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up if you haven't already to listen to Hour 2 and all our previous programs, a wealth of information and knowledge for the hungry seeker and those who are looking to expand their perspectives on life is waiting for you right there. We'll be back with Susan Posel from Occupy Corporatism next, and later David Icke and Charles Eisenstein, to name a few. Thank you for listening, guys and gals. More wisdom from Scott is coming up, and we'll see you at redicemembers.com.